part of the men in the family, as has been asserted, is unclear. There would have been every reason for the women to have been exhausted as well. But the standouts in the generations immediately preceding Cleopatra's were, for vision, ambition, intellect, universally female. Cleopatra, moreover, came of age in a country that entertained a singular definition of women's roles. Well before her, and centuries before the arrival of the Ptolemies, Egyptian women enjoyed the right to make their own marriages. Over time, their liberties had increased to levels unprecedented in the ancient world. They inherited equally and held property independently. Married women did not submit to their husband's control. They enjoyed the right to divorce and to be supported after a divorce. Until the time an ex-wife's dowry was returned, she was entitled to be lodged in the house of her choice. Her property remained hers. It was not to be squandered by a wastrel husband. The law sided with the wife and children if a husband acted against their interests. Romans marveled that in Egypt, female children were not left to die. A Roman was obligated to raise only his firstborn daughter. Egyptian women married later than did their neighbors as well, only about half of them by Cleopatra's age. They loaned money and operated barges. They served as priests in the native temples. They initiated lawsuits and hired flute players. As wives, widows, or divorcees, they owned vineyards, wineries, papyrus marshes, ships, perfume businesses, milling equipment, slaves, homes, camels. As much as one-third of Ptolemaic Egypt may have been in female hands. So much did these practices reverse the natural order of things that they astounded the foreigner. At the same time, they seemed wholly in keeping with a country whose magnificent, life-giving river flowed backward from south to north, establishing Upper Egypt in the south and Lower Egypt in the north. The Nile further reversed the laws of nature by swelling in summer and subsiding in winter. The Egyptians harvested their fields in April and sowed them in November. Even planting was inverted. The Egyptian first sowed, then plowed, to cover the seed in loose earth. This made perfect sense in the kind of aberrant kingdom where one kneaded dough with one's feet and wrote from right to left. It was no wonder that Herodotus should have asserted, in an account Cleopatra would have known well, that Egyptian women ventured into the markets while the men sat at home tending their looms. We have ample testimony to her sense of humor. Cleopatra was a wit and a prankster. There is no cause to question how she read Herodotus's further assertion that Egypt was a country in which the women urinate standing up, the men sitting down. On another account, Herodotus was entirely correct. There is no country that possesses so many wonders, nor any that has such a number of works that defy description, he marveled. Well before the Ptolemies, Egypt exercised its spell on the world. It boasted an ancient civilization, any number of natural oddities, monuments of baffling immensity, two of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The capacity for wonder may have been greater in Cleopatra's day, but the pyramids were taller too, by 31 feet. And in the intermissions between bloodlettings, largely in the 3rd century and before the dynasty began to wobble under its own depravity late in the 2nd, the Ptolemies had made good on Alexander the Great's plans, establishing on the Nile Delta a miracle of a city, one that was as sleekly sophisticated as its founding people had been unpolished. From a distance, Alexandria blinded, a sumptuous suffusion of gleaming marble over which presided its towering lighthouse. Its celebrated skyline was reproduced on lamps, mosaics, tiles. The city's architecture announced its magpie ethos, forged of a frantic accretion of cultures. In this greatest of Mediterranean ports, papyrus fronds topped Ionic columns. Oversized sphinxes and falcons lined the paths to Greek temples. Crocodile gods in Roman dress decorated Doric tombs. built in the finest situation in the world. Alexandria stood sentry over a land of fabled riches and fantastic creatures, a favorite enigma to the Roman world. To a man like Julius Caesar, who for all his travels had never before set foot in Egypt, few of its astonishments would have been as great as the quick-witted young woman who had emerged from the traveler's sack. She was born in 69 BC, the second of three daughters. Two brothers followed, to each of which Cleopatra would in succession be briefly joined in marriage. While there was never a particularly safe time to be born a Ptolemy, the first century may have been among the worst. All five siblings met violent ends. Among them, Cleopatra distinguishes herself for having alone dictated the circumstances of her demise, no small accomplishment, and in Roman terms, a distinction of some weight. The very fact that she was still alive at the time of Caesar's arrival was testimony to her character. She had clearly been conspiring for a year or more, energetically for months, nearly around the clock over the late summer weeks. Equally significant was the fact that she would outlive her siblings by decades. Neither brother survived adolescence. Of Cleopatra's mother, we have neither glimpse nor echo. She disappears from the scene early in Cleopatra's childhood and was dead by the time Cleopatra was 12. It is unclear if her daughter knew her any better than do we. She seems to have been one of the rare Ptolemaic women to have opted out of the family melodrama. Footnote. It is also unclear whether she was Cleopatra's mother. Although if Cleopatra were illegitimate, it is unlikely that the detail would have escaped her detractors. End of footnote. Cleopatra V Tryphena was in any event several decades younger than Auletes, her brother or half-brother. The two had married shortly after Auletes ascended to the throne. The fact that his aunt contested his right to the kingship, she went so far as to travel to Rome to press the case against him, is not particularly meaningful, given the family dynamic. It may, however, speak to her political instincts. To many minds, Auletes appeared more interested in the arts than in statecraft. Despite a rule that lasted 22 years, with one interruption, he would be remembered as the pharaoh who piped while Egypt collapsed. Of Caesar's early years, virtually nothing is recorded, and Cleopatra goes him one better. We have no clues at all. Were her childhood home not today 20 feet underwater, or were the climate of Alexandria more forgiving toward ancient papyri, it is unlikely that we would be further enlightened. Childhood was not a big seller in the ancient world, where fate and pedigree were the formative influences. The ancient players tended to emerge fully formed. We can safely assume that Cleopatra was born in the palace of Alexandria, that a wet nurse cared for her, that a household retainer chewed her first foods before placing them in her gummy mouth, that nothing passed her childhood lips that had not first been tasted for poison, that she counted among her playmates a gaggle of noble-born children known as foster siblings and destined to become the royal entourage. Even as she scampered down the colonnaded walkways of the palace, past its fountains and fish ponds, or through its lush groves and zoological garden, earlier Ptolemies had kept giraffes, rhinoceroses, bears, a 45-foot python. She was surrounded by a retinue. From an early age, she was comfortable among politicians, ambassadors, scholars, at ease among a flock of purple-cloaked court officials. She played with terracotta dolls and dollhouses and tea sets and miniature furniture, with dice and rocking horses and knuckle bones and pet mice, though we will never know what she did with her dolls and whether, like Indira Gandhi, she engaged them in insurrections and battles. Along with her older sister, Cleopatra was groomed for the throne, a Ptolemy planned for all eventualities. She made regular trips up the Nile to the family's harbor-front palace in Memphis to participate in traditional Egyptian cult festivals, carefully stage-managed, opulent processions of family, advisors, and staff. 200 miles upriver, Memphis was a sacred city, managed by a hierarchy of priests. Death has been said to have been its greatest business. Vast animal catacombs stretched under its center, a magnet for the pilgrims who came to worship and to stock up on miniature mummified hawks and crocodiles at its souvenir stands. At home, these were objects of veneration. On such occasions, Cleopatra would have been outfitted in ceremonial dress, though not yet in the traditional Egyptian crown of plumes, sun disk, and cow's horns. And from an early age, she enjoyed the best education available in the Hellenistic world, at the hands of the most gifted scholars, in what was incontestably the greatest center of learning in existence, the Library of Alexandria and its attached museum were literally in her backyard. The most prestigious of its scholars were her tutors, its men of science, her doctors. She did not have to venture far for a prescription, a eulogy, a mechanical toy, a map. That education may well have exceeded her father's, raised abroad in northeastern Asia Minor, but would have been a traditional Greek education in every respect, nearly identical to that of Caesar, whose tutor had studied in Alexandria. It was preeminently literary. Letters mattered in the Greek world, where they served additionally as numbers and musical notes. Cleopatra learned to read first by chanting the Greek alphabet, then by tracing letters incised by her teacher on a narrow wooden tablet. The successful student went on to practice them in continuous horizontal rows, later in columns, eventually in reverse order, ultimately in pairs from either end of the alphabet, in capitals, and again in cursive. When Cleopatra graduated to syllables, it was to a body of abstruse, unpronounceable words. The more outlandish, the better. The lines of doggerel that followed were equally esoteric. The theory appears to have been that the student who could decode these could decode anything. Maxims and verse came next, based on fables and myths. A student might be called upon to render a tale of Aesop's in his own words, in simplest form, a second time with grandiloquence. More complex impersonations came later. She might write as Achilles on the verge of being killed, or be called upon to restate a plot of Euripides. The lessons were neither easy nor meant to be. Learning was a serious business, involving endless drills, infinite rules, long hours. There was no such thing as a weekend. One studied on all save for festival days, which came with merciful regularity in Alexandria. Twice a month, all ground to a halt on Apollo's account. Discipline was severe. The ears of a youth are on his back. He listens when he is beaten, reads an early papyrus. Into that adage, the playwright Menander injected cause and effect. He who is not thrashed cannot be educated. Generations of schoolchildren dutifully inscribed that line on the red wax centers of wooden slates with their ivory styluses. Even before she graduated to sentences, even before she learned to read, the love affair with Homer began. Homer was not a man, but a god, figured among the early penmanship lessons, as did the first cantos of the Iliad. No text more thoroughly penetrated Cleopatra's world. In an age infatuated with history and calibrated in glory, Homer's work was the Bible of the day. He was the prince of literature. His 15,693 lines provided the moral, political, historical, and religious context, the great deeds and the ruling principles, the intellectual atlas, and moral compass. The educated man cited him, paraphrased him, alluded to him. It was entirely fair to say that children like Cleopatra were, as a near contemporary had it, nursed in their learning by Homer and swaddled in his verses. Alexander the Great was believed to have slept always with a copy of Homer under his pillow. Any cultivated Greek, Cleopatra included, could recite some part of the Iliad and the Odyssey by heart. The former was more popular in Cleopatra's Egypt. It may have seemed a more pertinent tale for a turbulent time, but from an early age she would have known, literally, what she at 21 discovered empirically. There were days you felt like waging war, and days when you just needed to go home. On a primary level, the indoctrination began with vocabulary lists of gods, heroes, rivers. More sophisticated assignments followed. What song did the sirens sing? Was Penelope chaste? Who was Hector's mother? The tangled genealogies of the gods would have posed little difficulty to a Ptolemaic princess, next to whose history theirs paled, and with whose theirs intersected. The border between the human and divine was fluid for Cleopatra. The schoolroom lessons merged again with her personal history in the study of Alexander, the other preeminent classroom hero. Cleopatra would have known his story backward and forward, as she would have known every exploit of her Ptolemaic ancestors. The early questions were formulaic, the brain fundamentally more retentive. Memorization was crucial. Which gods aid whom? What was Ulysses' route? This was the kind of material with which Cleopatra's head would have been stuffed. It passed for erudition in her day, and it would not have been easy to evade. The royal entourage included philosophers, rhetoricians, and mathematicians, at once mentors and servants, intellectual companions, and trusted advisors. While Homer set the gold standard, a vast catalog of literature followed. Clearly, the rollicking domestic dramas of Menander were a classroom favorite, though it is equally clear that the comic playwright was less read later. Cleopatra knew her Aesop's fables, as she would have known her Herodotus and Thucydides. She read more poetry than prose, though it is possible she knew the texts we read today as Ecclesiastes and First Maccabees. Among playwrights, Euripides was the established favorite, subtly suited to the times, with his stable of transgressive women who reliably supply the brains of the operation. She would have known various scenes by heart. Aeschylus and Sophocles, Hesiod, Pindar, and Sappho would all have been familiar to Cleopatra and the clique of well-born girls at her side. As much for her as for Caesar, there was little regard for what was not Greek. She probably learned even her Egyptian history from three Greek texts. Some schooling in arithmetic, geometry, music, and astrology and astronomy, the last two largely indistinguishable, accompanied her literary studies. Cleopatra knew the difference between a star and a constellation, and she could likely strum a lyre, though all were subordinate to them. Even Euclid could not answer the student who had asked what precisely the use for geometry might be. Cleopatra tackled none of those texts on her own. She read aloud, or was read to by teachers or servants. Silent reading was less common, in public or private. A 20-sheet-long scroll of papyrus was both unwieldy and fragile. Reading was very much a two-handed operation. You balanced the scroll in your right hand and rolled the used portion with your left. Either a grammarian or a retinue of them worked with her on decoding her first sentences, a vexed assignment in a language transcribed without word breaks, punctuation, or paragraphs. For good reason, sight reading was considered an accomplishment, the more so as it was meant to be done with verve and expression, careful enunciation, and effective gestures. At 13 or 14, Cleopatra graduated to the study of rhetoric or public speaking, along with philosophy, the greatest and most powerful art, as her brother's tutor had amply demonstrated on Pompey's arrival. Theodotus may at one time have been Cleopatra's tutor as well. she would have had a dedicated tutor, most likely a eunuch. The rhetoric master worked the real magic. Though less so for girls, Cleopatra's was a speechifying culture, appreciative of the shapely argument, of the fine arts of persuasion and refutation. One declaimed with a codified vocabulary and an arsenal of gestures, in something of a cross between the laws of verse and those of parliamentary procedure. Cleopatra learned to marshal her thoughts precisely, express them artistically, deliver them gracefully. Content arguably took second place to delivery, for, noted Cicero, as reason is the glory of man, so the lamp of reason is eloquence. Head high, eyes bright, voice carefully modulated, she mastered the eulogy, the reproach, the comparison. In terse and vigorous language, summoning a wealth of anecdote and allusion, she would have learned to discourse on a host of thorny issues. Why is Cupid depicted as a winged boy with arrows? Is country or town life preferable? Does Providence govern the world? What would you say, were you Medea, on the verge of slaughtering your children? The questions were the same everywhere, although the answers may have varied. Some queries, is it fair to murder your mother if she has murdered your father, for one, may have been handled differently in Cleopatra's household than elsewhere. And despite the formulaic quality, history quickly crept into the exercises. Soon students would debate whether Caesar should have punished Theodotus, he of the dead men don't bite coinage. Was Pompey's murder actually a gift to Caesar? What of the question of honor? Should Caesar have killed Ptolemy's advisor to avenge Pompey? Or would doing so suggest that Pompey had not deserved to die? Footnote. Theodotus escaped, but was tracked down. By the time he began to figure in classroom discussions, he had been crucified. End of footnote. Would war with Egypt be wise at such a time? These arguments were to be made with particular and exact choreography. Cleopatra was instructed as to where to breathe, pause, gesticulate, pick up her pace, lower or raise her voice. She was to stand erect. She was not to twiddle her thumbs. Assuming the raw material was not defective, it was the kind of education that could be guaranteed to produce a vivid, persuasive speaker, as well as to provide that speaker with ample opportunity to display her subtle mind and clever wit, in social settings as much as in judicial proceedings. The art of speaking, it was later said, depends on much effort, continual study, varied kinds of exercise, long experience, profound wisdom, and unfailing strategic sense. It was elsewhere noted that this grueling course of study lent itself equally to the court, the stage, or the ravings of a lunatic. Cleopatra neared the end of her training, just as her father succumbed to a fatal illness in 51. In a solemn ceremony before Egypt's high priest, she and her brother ascended to the throne, probably late that spring. If the ceremony conformed to tradition, it took place in Memphis, Egypt's spiritual capital, where a sphinx-lined causeway led through dunes of sand to the main temple, with its limestone panthers and lions, its Greek and Egyptian chapels, painted in glowing color and hung with brilliant banners. Amid clouds of incense, Cleopatra was fitted with the serpent crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt by a priest in a long linen gown, a panther's skin slung across his shoulder. She took her oath within the sanctuary, in Egyptian. Only then was her diadem fitted into place. The new queen was 18, Ptolemy XIII, 8 years younger. Generally, hers was a precocious age. Alexander the Great was a general at 16, master of the world at 20. And, as was observed later in connection with Cleopatra, some women are younger at 70 than most women at 17. How she fared is plain to see. The culture was oral. Cleopatra knew how to talk. Even her detractors gave her high marks for verbal dexterity. Her sparkling eyes are never mentioned without equal tribute to her eloquence and charisma. She was naturally suited to declaim, with a rich, velvety voice, a commanding presence, and gifts both for appraising and accommodating her audience. On that count, she had advantages Caesar did not. As much as Alexandria belonged to the Greek world, it happened to be located in Africa. At the same time, it was in, but not of, Egypt. One journeyed between the two, as today one journeys from Manhattan to America, though with a swap of languages in the ancient case. From the start, Cleopatra was accustomed to playing to dual audiences. Her family ruled a country that, even in the ancient world, astonished with its antiquity. Its language was the oldest on record. That language was also formal and clumsy, with a particularly difficult script. The script was demotic. Hieroglyphs were used purely for ceremonial occasions. Even the literate could decipher them only in part. Cleopatra was unlikely to have been able to read them easily. It made for a far more demanding assignment than Greek. By Cleopatra's day, the language of business and bureaucracy, and which came easily to an Egyptian speaker. While Egyptian speakers learned Greek, it was rare that anyone ventured in the opposite direction. To the punishing study of Egyptian, however, Cleopatra applied herself. She was allegedly the first and only Ptolemy to bother to learn the language of the 7 million people over whom she ruled. The accomplishment paid off handsomely. Where previous Ptolemies had commanded armies through interpreters, Cleopatra communicated directly. For someone recruiting mercenaries among Syrians and Medians and Thracians, that was a distinct advantage, as it was to anyone with imperial ambitions. It was an advantage as well closer to home, in a restive, ethnically diverse, cosmopolitan city, to which immigrants flocked from all over the Mediterranean. An Alexandrian contract could involve 7 different nationalities. It was not unusual to see a Buddhist monk on the streets of the city, home to the largest community of Jews outside Judea, a community that may have accounted for nearly a quarter of Alexandria's population. Egypt's profitable luxury trade was with India. Lustrous silks, spices, ivory, and elephants traveled across the Red Sea and along caravan routes. There was ample reason why Cleopatra should have been particularly adept in the tongues of the coastal region. Plutarch gave her 9 languages, including Hebrew and troglodyte, an Ethiopian tongue that, if Herodotus can be believed, was unlike that of any other people. It sounds like the screeching of bats. Cleopatra's rendition was evidently more mellifluous. It was a pleasure merely to hear the sound of her voice, notes Plutarch, with which, like an instrument of many strings, she could pass from one language to another, so that there were few of the barbarian nations that she answered by an interpreter. To most of them, she spoke herself. Plutarch is silent on the subject of Cleopatra's Latin, the language of Rome, little spoken in Alexandria. Remarkable orators both, she and Caesar certainly communicated in a very similar Greek, but the linguistic divide spoke volumes about the bind in which Cleopatra now found herself, as it did about her legacy and her future. A generation earlier, a good Roman had avoided Greek whenever possible, going so far even as to feign ignorance. "The better one gets to know Greek," went the wisdom, "the more a scoundrel one becomes." It was the tongue of high art and low morals, the dialect of sex manuals, a language with fingers of its own. "The Greeks covered all bases," noted a later scholar, "including some I should not care to explain in class." Footnote. The history parallels that of French on American soil. In colonial America, the language of the dissolute old world was a vehicle of contagion. Where French went, depravity and frivolity were sure to follow. By the 19th century, French was the indispensable agent of high culture, fuller of expression, richer of vocabulary, somehow maddeningly superior in its nuance and suppleness. At its edges, the admiration bordered on resentment, to which it finally succumbed. An eventful century later, French was outmoded, long-winded, largely irrelevant, an affectation. End of footnote. Caesar's generation, which perfected its education in Greece or under Greek-speaking tutors, handled both languages with equal finesse, with Greek by far the richer, the more nuanced, the more subtle, sweet, and obliging tongue, forever supplying the mot juste. From the time of Cleopatra's birth, an educated Roman was a master of both. For a fleeting moment, it seemed as if a Greek-speaking East and West might just be possible. 2 decades later, Cleopatra would negotiate with Romans who were ill at ease in her language. She would play her last scene in Latin, which she certainly spoke with an accent. An aesthete and a patron of the arts under whom Alexandria enjoyed the beginnings of an intellectual revival, Auletes saw to it that his daughter received a first-rate education. Cleopatra would continue the tradition, engaging a distinguished tutor for her own daughter. She was not alone in doing so. While girls were by no means universally educated, they headed off to schools, entered poetry competitions, became scholars. More than a few well-born first-century daughters, including those not being groomed for thrones, went far in their studies, if not all the way to rigorous rhetorical training. Pompey's daughter had a fine tutor and recited Homer for her father. In his expert opinion, Cicero's daughter was extremely learned. Brutus's mother was equally well-versed in her Latin and Greek poets. Alexandria had its share of female mathematicians, doctors, painters, and poets. This did not mean such women were above suspicion. As always, an educated woman was a dangerous woman, but she was less a source of discomfort in Egypt than elsewhere. Footnote. The Hellenistic version of pregnant and barefoot in the kitchen was a Roman epithet. She loved her husband, she bore 2 sons, she kept the house and worked in wool. End of footnote. Pompey's beautiful wife Cornelia, only yards away when her husband's head was hacked off at Pelusium, she had shrieked in horror, had a similar formation to Cleopatra's. She was highly educated, played well upon the lute, and understood geometry, and had been accustomed to listen with profit to lectures on philosophy. All this, too, without in any degree becoming unamiable or pretentious, as sometimes young women do when they pursue such studies. The admiration was grudging, but it was admiration all the same. Of a Roman consul's wife, it was conceded, shortly after Cleopatra introduced herself to Caesar that fall, that for all her dangerous gifts, she was a woman of no mean endowments. She could write verses, bandy jests, and use language which was modest or tender or wanton. In fine, she possessed a high degree of wit and of charm. To Caesar, then, Cleopatra was in some ways profoundly familiar. She was also a living link to Alexander the Great, the exquisite product of a highly refined civilization, heir to a dazzling intellectual tradition. Alexandrians had been studying astronomy when Rome was little more than a village. What was reborn with the Renaissance was on many fronts the Alexandria that Cleopatra's forebears had built. Somehow, despite the years of savagery and the vacuous Macedonian cultural record, the Ptolemies established in Alexandria the greatest intellectual center of its time, one that had picked up where Athens had left off. When Ptolemy I had founded the library, he had set out to gather every text in existence, to which end he made considerable progress. His gluttony for literature was such that he was said to have seized all texts arriving in the city, on occasion returning copies in their stead. He also offered rewards for contributions. Spurious texts materialized in the Alexandrian collection as a result. Ancient sources indicate that the great library included 500,000 scrolls, which would appear to be a hopeless exaggeration. 100,000 may be closer to the truth. In any event, the collection dwarfed all prior libraries and included every volume written in Greek. Those texts were nowhere more accessible or more neatly arranged, ordered alphabetically and by subject. They occupied individual cubbies than in the great library of Alexandria. Nor were those texts in any danger of collecting dust. Attached to the library, near or within the palace complex, was the museum, a state-subsidized research institute. While teachers elsewhere in the Hellenistic world were held in little esteem, "He's either dead or off teaching somewhere," went the expression. A teacher earned slightly more than an unskilled laborer. Scholarship reigned supreme in Alexandria. So did this community of scholars, cosseted by the state, housed tax-free in luxurious quarters, fed in a vast communal dining hall. Such was true, anyway, until 100 years before Cleopatra, when her great-grandfather decided he had had enough of that politically obstreperous class and thinned the ranks, dispersing the best and the brightest across the ancient world. For centuries both before and after Cleopatra, the most impressive thing a doctor could say was that he had trained in Alexandria. It was where you hoped your children's tutor had studied. The library was the pride of the civilized world, a legend in its lifetime. By Cleopatra's day, it was no longer in its prime, its work having devolved from original studies to the kind of manic classifying and cataloging that gave us the 7 wonders of the world. One bibliographical masterwork cataloged those persons eminent in every branch of learning, with alphabetical lists of their writings divided by subject. The study swelled to 120 volumes. The institution continued all the same to attract the great minds of the Mediterranean. Its patron saint was Aristotle, whose school and library stood as its model, and who had, not incidentally, taught both Alexander the Great and his childhood friend, Ptolemy the First. It was in Alexandria that the circumference of the earth was first measured, the sun fixed at the center of the solar system, the workings of the brain and the pulse illuminated, the foundations of anatomy and physiology established, the definitive editions of Homer produced. It was in Alexandria that Euclid had codified geometry. If all the wisdoms of the ancient world could be said to have been collected in one place, that place was Alexandria. Cleopatra was its direct beneficiary. She knew that the moon had an effect on tides, that the earth was spherical and revolved around the sun. She knew of the existence of the equator, the value of pi, the latitude of Marseille, the behavior of linear perspective, the utility of a lightning conductor. She knew that one could sail from Spain to India, a voyage that was not to be made for another 1,500 years, though she herself would consider making it, in reverse. For a man like Caesar, then highly cultivated, enthralled to Alexander the Great, and who claimed descent from Venus, all roads, mythical, historical, intellectual, led to Alexandria. Like Cleopatra, his education was first rate, his curiosity voracious. He knew his poets. He was an omnivorous reader. Though the Romans were said to have no taste for personal luxury, Caesar was, as in so many matters, the exception. Even on campaign, he was an insatiable collector of mosaic, marble, and gems. His invasion of Britain had been written down to his fondness for freshwater pearls. Seduced by opulence and pedigree, he had lingered in Oriental courts before, to his lifelong embarrassment. Few charges disconcerted him, as did the accusation that he had prolonged his stay in what is today northern Turkey because of his affair with the king of Bithynia. Caesar was of illustrious birth, a gifted orator, and a dashing officer. But those distinctions were meaningless compared to a woman who, however inventively, descended from Alexander, who was in Egypt not only royal but divine. Caesar was very nearly deified in the last years of his life. Cleopatra was born a goddess. And her looks? While the Romans who preserved her story assure us of Cleopatra's wanton ways, her feminine wiles, her ruthless ambition, and her sexual depravity, few raved about her beauty. That was not for lack of adjectives. Sublime women entered the historical record. Herod's wife was one. Alexander the Great's mother was another. The sixth dynasty queen thought to have built the third pyramid was, as Cleopatra would have known, braver than all the men of her time, the most beautiful of all the women, fair-skinned with red cheeks. Arsinoe II, the thrice-married third-century intriguer, was stunning. Beauty had unsettled the world before. The Helen illusion was there for the asking, but only one Latin poet picked up on it, primarily to emphasize Cleopatra's bad behavior. Plutarch clearly notes that her beauty was not in itself so remarkable that none could be compared with her, or that no one could see her without being struck by it. It was rather the contact of her presence, if you lived with her, that was irresistible. Her personality and manner, he insists, were no less than bewitching. Time has done better than fail to wither in Cleopatra's case. It has improved upon her allure. She came into her looks only years later. By the 3rd century A.D., she would be described as striking, exquisite in appearance. By the Middle Ages, she was famous for nothing but her beauty. As no stone portrait of her has yet proved authentic, André Malraux's quip remains partly true. Nefertiti is a face without a queen. Cleopatra is a queen without a face. All the same, a few matters can be resolved. It would have been surprising had she been anything other than small and lithe, although the men in the family tended toward fat, if not full-fledged obesity. Even allowing for the authoritarian message she intended to broadcast and for cut-rate engraving, coin portraits support Plutarch's claim that she was by no means a conventional beauty. She sported a smaller version of her father's hooked nose, common enough that there is a word for it in Greek. Full lips, a sharp, prominent chin, a high brow. Her eyes were wide and sunken. While there were fair-haired, fair-skinned Ptolemies, Cleopatra VII was very likely not among them. It is difficult to believe that the world could have nattered on about that Egyptian woman had she been blonde. The word honey-skinned recurs in descriptions of her relatives and would presumably have applied to her as well, despite the inexactitudes surrounding her mother and paternal grandmother. There was certainly Persian blood in the family, but even an Egyptian mistress is a rarity among the Ptolemies. She was not dark-skinned. Certainly her face did nothing to undermine her redoubtable charm, her easy humor, or her silken powers of persuasion. Caesar was particular about appearances. For him, there were other considerations as well. It had long been clear that the way into Pompey's heart was through flattery, the way into Caesar's through bribery. He spent freely and beyond his budget. One mistress's pearl cost the equivalent of what 1,200 professional soldiers earned in a year. After more than a decade of warfare, he had an army to pay. Cleopatra's father had left an outstanding debt, which Caesar spoke of recouping on his arrival. He would forgive half, which left an astronomical balance of some 3,000 talents. He had extravagant expenses and extravagant tastes, but Egypt had, Caesar knew, a treasury to match. The captivating young woman before him, who spoke so effectively, laughed so easily, hailed from an ancient, accomplished culture, moved amid an opulence that would set his countrymen's teeth on edge, and had so artfully outfoxed an army, was one of the two richest people in the world. On his return to the palace, the other was horrified to discover his sister with Caesar. He stormed out to throw a temper tantrum in the street. Chapter 3. Cleopatra captures the old man by magic. A woman who is generous with her money is to be praised. Not so if she is generous with her person. Quintilian. Very little about the first century BC was original. Mostly it distinguished itself for its compulsive recycling of familiar themes. So it was that when a fiery wisp of a girl presented herself before an adroit, much older man of the world, credit for the seduction fell to her. For some time already, that brand of encounter had occasioned the clucking of tongues, as it would for several millennia. In truth, it is unclear who seduced whom, just as it is unclear how quickly Caesar and Cleopatra fell into each other's arms. A great deal was at stake on both sides. Plutarch has the indomitable general helpless before the beguiling 21-year-old. He is, in two swift steps, captivated by her ruse and overcome by her charm. Apollodorus came, Caesar saw, Cleopatra conquered. A sequence of events that does not necessarily add up in her favor. In his account, it may well derive from Plutarch's, which preceded it by a good century. Dio, too, acknowledges Cleopatra's power to subjugate a man twice her age. His Caesar is instantly and entirely enslaved. Dio allows, however, for a hint of complicity on the part of the Roman, known to harbor a fondness for the opposite sex, to such an extent that he had his intrigues with ever so many other women. With all, doubtless, who chanced to come his way. This is to grant Caesar something of a role, rather than to leave him defenseless in the hands of a devious, disarming siren. Dio offers, too, a more elaborate staging. In the palace, Cleopatra has time to primp. She appears in the most majestic and, at the same time, pity-inspiring guise, a rather tall order. His Caesar is a convert upon seeing her and hearing her speak a few words, words that Cleopatra surely chose with great care. She had never before met the Roman general and had little idea what to expect. She would have known only that, in a worst-case scenario, it was preferable to be taken prisoner by Julius Caesar than by her own brother. Footnote. Neither account was written from living memory. In only one version, a blundering 6th century AD account, does anyone venture to make the shocking assertion that Caesar might have seduced Cleopatra. End of footnote. By all accounts, Cleopatra came easily to some sort of accommodation with Caesar, who was soon enough acting as advocate for the very woman whose judge he had previously assumed to be. The seduction may have taken some time, or at least longer than the one night of legend. We have no proof that the relationship was immediately sexual. By the clear light of day, if not necessarily the morning after the unorthodox, show-stopping arrival, Caesar proposed a reconciliation between Cleopatra and Ptolemy, on the condition that she should rule as his colleague in the kingdom. This was by no means what her brother's advisers were expecting. They had the upper hand. They assumed that they had signed a pact with Caesar on the beach at Pelusium. nor were they banking on Cleopatra's unaccountable appearance in the palace. Young Ptolemy was, if anything, more surprised to find her there than Caesar had been. Furious to have been outwitted, he resorted to behavior that suggested he very much needed a consort. He burst into tears. In his rage, he flew through the gates and into the crowd outside. Amid his subjects, he tore the white ribbon from his head and cast it to the ground, wailing that his sister had betrayed him. Caesar's men seized and returned him to the palace, where he remained under house arrest. It took them longer to quiet the violence in the street, much encouraged in the weeks to come by Plotinus the eunuch, who had led the move to depose Cleopatra. Her glorious career would have ended here had she not secured Caesar's favor. Assaulted as he was by both land and sea, Caesar might have ended his here as well. He believed he was settling a family vendetta, did not understand that with two bedraggled and depleted legions, he had incited a full-scale rebellion. Nor does Cleopatra appear to have enlightened him as to her lack of support among the Alexandrians. Apprehensive, Caesar arranged to appear before the people. From a safe place, it seems to have been an upper-story balcony or a window of the palace, he promised to do for them whatever they wished. Here the well-honed rhetorical skills came in handy. Cleopatra may have briefed Caesar on how to appease the Alexandrians, but he needed no tutor to deliver a clear, compelling oration, one he typically punctuated with vigorous hand gestures. He was an acknowledged genius in that realm, a pitch-perfect speaker and a lapidary stylist, unsurpassed in the ability to inflame the minds of his hearers and to turn them in whatever direction the case demands. He made no reference later to his alarm, focusing instead on his negotiation with Ptolemy, and asserting that he was himself particularly anxious to play the part of friend and arbitrator. He appeared to succeed. Ptolemy agreed to a reconciliation. No great concession, as he knew that his advisers would fight on regardless. They were at that moment secretly summoning the Ptolemaic army back to Alexandria. Caesar thereafter convoked a formal assembly, to which both siblings accompanied him. In his high, nasal tones, he read aloud Olete's will. Their father, he pointed out, had plainly directed Cleopatra and her brother to live together and rule in common under Roman guardianship. Caesar, thereby, bestowed the kingdom on them. It is impossible not to see Cleopatra's hand in what came next. To prove his goodwill, or, as Dio saw it, to calm an explosive crowd, Caesar went further. He bestowed the island of Cyprus on Cleopatra's two remaining siblings, 17-year-old Arsinoe and 12-year-old Ptolemy the 14th. The gesture was significant. The pearl of the Ptolemaic possessions, Cyprus commanded the Egyptian coast. It supplied the Egyptian kings with timber and afforded them a near monopoly on copper. Cyprus also represented a sore spot in Ptolemaic history. Cleopatra's uncle had ruled the island until a decade earlier, when Rome had demanded exorbitant sums from him. He chose poison over payment. His property was collected and carted off to Rome, where it was paraded through the streets. In Alexandria, his older brother, Cleopatra's father, had stood by silently, for which craven behavior his subjects had furiously expelled him from Egypt. Cleopatra was 11 at the time. She was unlikely to have forgotten either the humiliation or the revolt. Caesar succeeded in calming the populace, but failed to defuse hostilities so far as Plotinus was concerned. The ex-tutor lost no time in stirring up Achilles' men. The Roman proposal, he assured them, was a sham. Did they not happen to glimpse Cleopatra's long, lovely arm behind it? There is some kind of perverse testimony to be read in the fact that Plotinus, who knew her well, intimately, if indeed he had taught her, feared the young woman as much as he did the seasoned Roman. He swore that Caesar had given the kingdom ostensibly to both the children merely to quiet the people. As soon as he could, he would transfer it to Cleopatra alone. A second danger lurked as well, as indicative of Cleopatra's resolve, as of Ptolemy's lack of it. What if, while confined with him in the palace, that devious woman managed to seduce her brother? The people would never oppose a royal couple, even one sanctioned by an unpopular Roman. All would then be lost, insisted Plotinus. He devised a plan, which he evidently shared with too many of his co-conspirators. At the banquet held to celebrate the reconciliation, Caesar's barber — there was a reason barbershops served as post offices in Ptolemaic Egypt — made a startling discovery. That busy listening fellow, ever inquisitive, learned that Plotinus and Achillas meant to poison Caesar. While they were at it, they plotted Cleopatra's murder as well. Caesar was not surprised. He'd been sleeping sporadically and at odd hours to protect himself against assassination attempts. Cleopatra, too, must have found the nights uneasy, no matter how vigilant her guards. Caesar ordered a man to dispense with the eunuch, which was done. For his part, Achillas focused more intently on what was to become, in Plutarch's understated estimation, a troublesome and embarrassing war. Caesar had 4,000 men, hardly fresh or in any shape to feel invincible. Achillas's force was 5 times as great and marching toward Alexandria. And no matter what hints Cleopatra may have offered, Caesar had an insufficient grasp of the depths of Ptolemaic guile. Under the young king's name, Caesar dispatched 2 emissaries with a peace proposal. They were men of stature and experience. Both had served effectively under Cleopatra's father. Caesar had very likely met them earlier in Rome. Achillas, whom Caesar acknowledged to be a man of remarkable nerve, read the overture for the weaker hand it was. He murdered the ambassadors before they could so much as deliver their message. With the arrival of Egyptian troops in the city, Achillas attempted to break into Caesar's quarters. Frantically, under cover of darkness, the Romans fortified the palace with entrenchments and a 10-foot wall. Caesar might well be blockaded, but he did not care to fight against his will. He knew that Achillas was recruiting auxiliary troops in every corner of the country. Meanwhile, the Alexandrians established vast munitions factories throughout the city. The wealthy outfitted and paid their adult slaves to fight the Romans. Skirmishes erupted daily. Mostly, Caesar worried about water, of which he had little, and food, of which he had none. Already, Plotinus had pressed the point by delivering musty grain. As ever, the successful general was the gifted logician. It was essential that Caesar neither be separated from, nor vulnerable to, Lake Mareotis, south of the city and its second port. That brilliant blue freshwater lake connected Alexandria by canals to Egypt's interior. It was as rich and important as the 2 Mediterranean harbors. On the psychological front, there were additional considerations. Caesar did everything he could to court the young king, as he understood that the royal name had great authority with his people. To all who would listen, he broadcast regular reminders that the war was not Ptolemy's, but that of his rogue advisors. The protests fell on deaf ears. While Caesar tended to supply lines and fortifications, a second plot hatched in the palace, where the atmosphere must already have been strained, at least among the feuding siblings. Arsinoe, too, had a clever tutor. That eunuch now arranged her escape. His coup suggests either that Cleopatra was negligent, highly improbable under the circumstances, preoccupied with her brother and her own survival, or astutely double-crossed. It is unlikely that she underestimated her 17-year-old sister. Arsinoe burned with ambition. She was not the kind of girl who inspired complacency. She clearly had no great faith in Cleopatra, which sentiment she had presumably kept to herself for weeks. Footnote: we know nothing of Arsinoe's motives, which has not discouraged even the best modern interpreter of the Alexandrian War from speculation. Had she not felt jealous of her older sister's masterful seduction of Caesar, asserts one historian, she would not have been a woman. End of footnote. Outside the palace walls, she was more vocal. She was a Ptolemy, not enthralled to a foreigner, precisely what the Alexandrians preferred. They declared her queen. Every sister had now had a turn, and rallied exuberantly behind her. Arsinoe assumed her position at Achilles' side, at the head of the army. In her rooms at the palace, Cleopatra had further reason to believe it wiser to trust a Roman than a member of her own family. This, too, was old news by 48 BC.